Hi, this is Tony Bruschi. You're about to listen to our brand new podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia. Being a brand new show, we need to let other folks know that this thing exists so we can keep doing it. I'd greatly appreciate your help in that effort by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, and I'm going to make it worth your while as well. We're going to give away a $200 Amazon gift certificate to one person who left us a review. All you have to do is leave that review on Apple Podcasts, take a screenshot of it, and then send it to me. Send it to review@darksideofwiki.com. So, again, to review, leave the review at Apple Podcasts, take the screenshot, and then send it to me. review@darksideofwiki.com. That's the email address. review@darksideofwiki.com. Very soon, I'll select one person to get that $200 Amazon gift card as a thank you for leaving that review and letting other folks know we exist. Also, be sure to share us on social media, let your friends and family know, and be sure to press that subscribe button as well as we get another great podcast off the ground. I hope you enjoy The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Natural gas is oftentimes called the silent killer. One spring day in 1937, the residents of New London, Texas, would discover this fact all too well, as the school their children attended would instantly burst into flames while packed with students and faculty. This tragedy would leave a permanent scar on the town and bring a heightened awareness of natural gas and its dangers, paid for with their lives.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The New London School explosion occurred on March 18, 1937, when a natural gas leak caused an explosion, destroying the New London School in New London, Texas. A community in Rusk County, previously known as London. The disaster killed more than 295 students and teachers. As of 2017, the event is the third deadliest disaster in the history of Texas, after the 1900 Galveston hurricane and the 1947 Texas City disaster. And on that happy note, welcome to The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Tony and Jenny Bruschi with you for today's episode. And an interesting note about this episode and this topic in general, obviously not in our lifetime, but geographically very close to where Jenny grew up.
Yes, very close.
And as we'll learn in this story, some of the paths that were taken in the aftermath of this disaster within walking distance out your back door. Mm-hmm. And some very interesting connections that we'll make both with this story and some of the things that we've talked about on our other program, Real Ghost Stories Online. This obviously not the ghost show, but there's certain things that I feel as personal of a story as it is for you, where you grew up, that we should address some of those and talk about some of the your story that connects to this on the program today. So we'll continue on here with the story of the New London School explosion. In the mid-1930s, the Great Depression was in full swing, but the London School District was one of the richest in America. A 1930 oil fund in Rusk County had boosted the local economy, and educational spending grew with it. Its taxable value in 1937 had grown to $20 million, with additional revenue seen from 15 oil wells on district property. The London School, a large structure of steel and concrete, was constructed in 1932 at the cost of $1 million, roughly $18.7 million today. The London Wildcats, a play on the term wildcatter for an oil prospector, played football in the first stadium in the state to have electric lights. The school was built on sloping ground. A large airspace was enclosed beneath the structure. The school board had overridden the original architect's plans for a boiler and steam distribution system, instead opting to install 72 gas heaters throughout the building. In early 1937, the school board canceled their natural gas contract and had plumbers install a tap and to parade gasoline company's residue gas line to save money. This practice, while not explicitly authorized by local oil companies, was widespread in the area. The natural gas extracted with the oil was considered a waste product and was flared off. As there was no value to the natural gas, the oil companies turned a blind eye. This raw or wet gas varied in quality from day to day, even sometimes from hour to hour. Untreated natural gas is both odorless and colorless, so leaks are difficult to detect and may go unnoticed. Gas had been leaking from the residue line tap and built up inside the enclosed crawl space that ran the entire 253-foot length of the building's facade. Students had been complaining of headaches for some time, but little attention had been paid to the issue. March 18th was a Thursday. Friday's classes were canceled to allow students to participate in the neighboring city of Henderson's Interscholastic Meet, a scholastic and athletic competition. Following the school's normal schedule, first through fourth grade students had been let out early. A PTA meeting was being held in the gymnasium. A separate structure, roughly 100 feet from the main building, approximately 500 students and 40 teachers were in the building at this time, although some numbers claim there were roughly 694 students in the building at the campus. At 3:17 p.m., Lemire L. Butler, an instructor of manual training, turned on an electric sander. It's believed that the sander switch caused a spark that ignited the gas-air mixture. Reports from witnesses state that the walls of the school bulged, the roof lifted from the building and then crashed back down, and the main wing of the structure collapsed. However, there was no fire after the explosion. Survivors in the building claim that lockers embedded in the walls were thrown at them by the blast. Others were picked up by the force of the explosion, and the plaster and mortar formed a white haze. The force of the explosion was so great that a 2-ton concrete block was thrown clear off the building and crushed a 1936 Chevrolet parked 200 feet away. Those who evacuated the building after the explosion were in a state of shock, with some recounting that they did not know what to do next, that it seemed the world was dead silent until the sound came back all at once. The explosion was its own alarm, reportedly heard up to 4 miles away from the school. The most immediate response was from parents at the PTA meeting. Within minutes, area residents started to arrive and begin digging through the rubble, many with their bare hands. Many survivors also joined in the immediate aftermath and the recovery of other survivors and victims. Roughnecks from the oil fields were released from their jobs and brought with them cutting torches and heavy equipment needed to clear the concrete and steel. Not all the buildings on the 10-acre campus were destroyed. School bus driver Lonnie Barber was transporting elementary students to their homes and was in sight of the school as it exploded. Barber continued his 2-hour routine and route, returning children to their parents before rushing back to the school to look for his 4 children. His son Arden died, but the others were not seriously injured. Barber retired the next year. Other school buses were employed to drive as an ambulance and survivors back to their homes, causing family members who were waiting at the bus stops to demand information from the students disembarking. So that's essentially what happened,
yeah,
on the day of the explosion. I had not been, I knew it was natural gas. I did not know the logistics of what happened. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting to hear essentially a before regulations were in place, it sounds like, with natural gas.
Right. And I'm sure it'll talk about this later, but the whole reason now when you smell gas is because of New London. They purposely make it have an odor so that you notice a leak. And before that, you know, it was just odorless. You would have no idea other than the kids complaining of the headaches.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is the death toll on this is still a mystery. It's, you know, it's been reported that it's been much higher than what they could document because being that New London was an oil town, oil workers back then, that was very much a migrant type thing. You would migrate from town to town, work the oil fields, move on. So however many workers were there with, you know, in that town at the time with their children would go to the school. So the records of that were very sketchy.
Because people did not have themselves documented as being working in that town because it wasn't like a permanent residence. It was a, you know, we go town to town, job to job, essentially.
Yeah. Okay. And the kids would just go to school. It wasn't the meticulous record keeping like we have now to where they know, you know, how many children exactly are in a building at any given time. They didn't do that back then. It was just like, oh, okay, your dad's over in the oil field. Sure. Go to school here.
Yeah. And at the time, too, then you wouldn't have also had, you know, today you would have news organizations, you know, demanding exact numbers and researching and all of that. Back then, it would just be an accepted who raised their hand and said they had a kid there. There's your count.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Wow. You've been to the memorial, right?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything left of the building? How is the memorial set up?
From what I remember, it was just basically a simple plaque in front of a building.
Mm-hmm.
But they had actually used part of the building that didn't collapse to be part of the school from that point forward. I don't know that. I mean, that part has probably long been demolished. It's been, you know, over 30 years since I've been to New London.
Yeah.
But they, right after this, used part of the existing structure that was not ruined as the school. So I don't know if that was, you know, still around at that time or not.
Yeah. Well, the idea of using still part of that structure. I mean, I'm sure it was more so being resourceful at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't imagine. You know, I mean, obviously we talk about ghosts on our other show. I can't imagine that building not being haunted.
Well, the part that exploded, that part was completely demolished. This
sure.
was like almost like an extension of it.
Like an annex building? Okay.
Yeah.
Still on property.
Mm-hmm.
It's still, yeah. Wow. Let's continue on with the story. Aid poured in from outside the area. Governor James Allard dispatched Texas Rangers, Highway Patrol, and the Texas National Guard. 30 doctors, 100 nurses, and 25 embalmers arrived from Dallas. Airmen from Barksdale Field, deputy sheriffs, and even Boy Scouts took part in the rescue and recovery. In their desperation to get victims and survivors out of the rubble, many rescuers did not immediately check if the body that they came across was alive or dead. Rescuers worked through the nights and rain, and 17 hours later, the entire site had been cleared. Many who worked in the rescue were overcome with shock, as one survivor recounted, "Daddy worked so long he almost had a nervous breakdown. As long as he was working, he was fine, but as soon as he came home and sat down, he'd start shaking." Buildings in the neighboring communities of Henderson, Overton, Kilgore, and as far away as Tyler and Longview were converted into makeshift first aid tents and morgues to house the enormous number of bodies. And everything from family cars to delivery trucks served as hearses and ambulances. A new hospital, Mother Frances Hospital in nearby Tyler, was scheduled to open the next day, but the dedication was canceled, and the hospital opened immediately. Reporters who arrived in the city found themselves swept up in the rescue efforts. Former Dallas Times Herald executive editor Felix McKnight, then a young AP reporter, recalled, "We identified ourselves and were immediately told that helpers were needed far more than reporters. Walter Cronkite also found himself in New London on one of his first assignments for UPI. Although Cronkite went on to cover World War II and the Nuremberg trials, he was quoted as saying decades later, "I did nothing in my studies nor in my life to prepare me for the story of the magnitude of that of the New London tragedy. Nor has any story since that awful day equaled it." So it's really interesting to think about the world at that time and how things are being covered and how the story is being told. But this certainly, I mean, it was national news, obviously. I mean, this would be worldwide news.
Yeah. This was definitely worldwide news. In fact, just kind of an ironic thing. Even Hitler sent his condolences.
Wow.
Before he became the Hitler we all knew and feared.
Yeah.
You know, just being the Chancellor of Germany.
That point in time, that's what.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. As far away as Tyler, and why don't you speak to that? That's where the area you grew up.
Yeah, I'm from a tiny town outside of Tyler.
Yeah.
It's called White House. And White House was a railroad town. It was actually named for the White House next to the tracks. That's how the train knew where it was. Mm-hmm. They just called it, we're by the White House. So they called it White House, Texas. And that was along the path that goes between New London and Tyler. And, you know, they talked about Mother Frances Hospital. That I had been to numerous times. My brother was born there. I had been there so many times, you know, taking all kinds of, you know, new sibling classes and stuff. That campus I was very familiar with. So it really kind of hits home with the whole, you know, my neck of the woods thing. But the railroad track, you know, they used the train to some degree to get people because, you know, driving that distance by a car in that day, you know, it took too long. So they would actually take people. And I think they actually took, you know, debris and they took the dead by train somewhat to get them someplace where they could be addressed. The train track actually went right behind my house.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you have something that happened this far in the past, obviously well before our lifetimes, well before even our parents' lifetimes. But when you are hearing about a setting where such a tragedy took place, and you're doing that, you're assimilating the hospital, the all these locations that you know about, they existed back then, obviously, and they played a big role in obviously this case. But it makes things that are so far back, not that it's not real, but it makes it more real. It makes it easier to digest. And I think it's a natural human thing where if you didn't live through the event in question, it is hard to say, I know how that feels.
Yeah.
Unless you can compare it to some other event that you do live through that was somewhat similar. You know, for our generation, you know, for example, you know, 9/11, you know, that's something where we would hear our grandparents talk about Pearl Harbor.
Sure.
And some of the things of World War II. And not that it wasn't real by any means. It was, you know, it was to us, it was a piece of history. It was very interesting. Tragic, yes. But, you know, we didn't have personal emotion, you know, of the day attached to it, or we can recall those moments and those feelings. And then obviously 9/11 happened. And then that was the first time I think I went, oh, okay, I get why they get choked up talking about Pearl Harbor or something. Like, I understand this perspective now. And I think that's normal. But whenever you can have those connections, even though you didn't live through this event here that we're talking about, the more, you know, the more connections you have to it, the more real it will feel, you know, and you have that more of that emotional connection to it.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, what's weird is events like 9/11 and things like that, you know, we talk about that for a very long time after this happened, you know, you lost an entire generation mm-hmm. in that town. People didn't talk about it. It was a fact that it happened and affected every family in town, but people did not talk about it. It wasn't until recently, like in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, that people started actually bringing it up, talking about it openly. And I think it's because any survivors and parents of those who lost children are gone now.
Yeah.
So now it's something that's brought up. But it was not until I was, you know, I went to the memorial, drove through the town, but I was so little. I didn't understand what was going on or what they talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But this was not until I was an adult that I actually learned about that and what happened.
Sure.
And then I started putting my puzzle pieces together.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you could stay living in the same town.
No.
You know, it would be like, I would have to just go and be like, we need a new setting. There's no way. And I imagine many people did that if they could, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of it would have to do with the means of, you know, can you just pick up and go, mm-hmm. you know? But you know, emotionally that would be so draining on, you know, if you're a survivor there and it's your kid or your husband or wife that was working there, both, whatever. You know, and then having to then, you know, send them back to school, the surviving mm-hmm. ones, you know, to the same place. I don't know how anyone would go through that and stay sane.
No, I don't know.
Let's continue on. Of the more than 600 people in the school, only about 130 escaped without serious injury. Estimates of the number of dead vary from 296 to 319, but that number could be much higher as many of the residents of New London at the time were transient oil field workers, and there is no way to determine how many volunteers collected the bodies of their children in the days following the disaster and returned them to their respective homes for burial. Of the deceased, the majority of them were from grades 5 through 11. As the younger students were educated in a separate building and most had already been dismissed from school. The majority of the victims of the explosion are buried at Pleasant Hill Cemetery near New London, with an entire section being designated for the victims. It was thought that one mother had a heart attack and died when she found out that her daughter had died. The only part of her face, her chin, and a couple of bones recovered, but this is the story was found to be untrue when both mother and daughter were found alive. Most of the bodies were either burned beyond recognition or blown to pieces. Most were identified by clothing or personal items, such as a boy who was identified by the presence of the pull string from his favorite shirt in his jeans pocket. A student survivor recounted being in a makeshift morgue. I saw fathers fight over dead children like dogs over a bone, yelling, "That's mine, no mine." I saw children who looked like roadkill. You couldn't tell if it was a boy, a girl, or what, unquote. Fingerprinting experts were brought in to take fingerprints from bodies that were disfigured by the explosion. This method of identification is available as many of the surrounding area had been fingerprinted at the Texas Centennial Exposition the previous summer. The surviving gymnasium was quickly converted into multiple classrooms inside tents and modified buildings. Classes resumed 10 days later, with the 30 surviving seniors completing the school year in the gymnasium. A new school was completed in 1939 on the property directly behind the location of the destroyed building. The school remained known as the London School until 1965, when London Independent School District consolidated with Gaston Independent School District. The name was changed to West Rock High School, and the mascot was changed to the Raiders. A lawsuit was brought against the school district and the Parade Gasoline Company, but the court ruled that neither could be held responsible. Superintendent W.C. Shaw was forced to resign amid talk of a lynching. He had lost a son, a niece, and nephew in the explosion. Adolf Hitler, who was the German Chancellor at the time, paid his respects in the form of a telegram, a copy of which is on display at the London Museum. Experts from the United States Bureau of Mines concluded that the connection to the residue gas line was faulty. The connection had allowed gas to leak into the school, and since natural gas is invisible and odorless, the leak was unnoticed. The sanding machine switch is believed to have caused a spark that ignited the gas-air mixture. To reduce the damage of future leaks, the Texas legislature began mandating within weeks of the explosion that fuels be added to natural gas. The strong odor of many of these fuels make leaks quickly detectable. The practice quickly spread worldwide. Shortly after the disaster, Texas legislature met in an emergency session and enacted the Engineering Registration Act, now rewritten as the Texas Engineering Practices Act. Public pressure was on the government to regulate the practice of engineering due to the faulty installation of the natural gas connection. Carolyn Jones, a 9-year-old survivor, spoke to the Texas legislature about the importance of safety in schools. The use of the title engineer in Texas remains legally restricted to those who have been professionally certified by the state to practice engineering. So that is some of the aftermath of what happened.
Yeah.
With the explosion. I want to talk a little bit more about, and this is what we had talked about on the our other program, Real Ghost Stories Online. And it's interesting, this topic came up 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
right around there. We were talking on our other program about, ghost, obviously, and the topic of imaginary friends popped up, and we were having a discussion about imaginary friends. And I had said to you that, well, I had an imaginary friend, but I knew it was my conscience, essentially. I was just talking to thin air, though. I never actually saw my imaginary friend. I never looked out there and thought, this person is a person.
Yeah.
I knew it to be imaginary. And when you're a kid, and if no one is defining this term to you, you're defining it as you see fit. And your reaction, if I remember correctly, was, wait a minute, you didn't actually see your imaginary friend?
Yeah, that's right. That was kind of surprising to me, because I didn't really talk about imaginary friends to any of the kids I went to school with.
Sure.
But I saw mine as plain as I see you sitting in front of me now.
Yeah.
You know, and looking back as an adult, looking at, you know, this little boy that I saw and I spent so much time playing with, I know now he was wearing like 1930s clothing. He had a little, you know, hat that was like, I don't know what it's called, but, you know, it's like little 1930s boy would wear.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked normal. He looked just like me, but he was always there.
Yeah.
And I knew others couldn't see him, but I could see him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from the time I was about probably 3 to almost 5, he was with me.
And when you're a kid, you think this is normal because everything is new.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, well, if other people can't see him, that's not a big deal. There's plenty of shit I didn't know that could be done, or here's how this works or that works. You just think it's normal. It's only in adulthood where you go, wait a second, and mm-hmm. you kind of revisit some of those thoughts. And you remember his attire specifically.
I do.
And he never, from your recollection, spoke to you of being from the school or anything. But but one would kind of put some pieces together going, well, why this era? Mm-hmm. Why... You know, it's an interesting thing. Were you, at the time when we had that conversation years ago, had you been aware of the school explosion, or did that cause you to do some research on the area and then you learned about it or kind of refreshed your memory on the fact that this existed?
It wasn't until I was, you know, upper teens to adulthood that I learned of the school explosion.
Mm-hmm.
I think we drove through there. My parents were curious on the way, probably going from Tyler to Kilgore or something, you know, and that was like another town over where you could, you know, we would take a day trip sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know, and nor would you tell a 3 or 4 year old child, oh, here's what happened. These kids went to school and they all died, because I wasn't in school yet. And that was the last thing you want to tell a child that's getting ready to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I didn't learn of what happened until much later, but I knew that he dressed different. He dressed different than any friends that I had that weren't imaginary, mm-hmm. but I still can see him in my mind. And it just all started to be put together because he didn't start coming to see me until right around the time that we went through there, but also about the time I went to that hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have to wonder if there's a connection there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I don't go and search through all the records of the ones that have died because I know that they're out there. And I know there was a little boy about his age
mm-hmm.
that didn't make it.
Yeah.
But I don't want to say, you know, definitively
yeah,
that it was him.
Sure.
But, you know, he taught me things that kids my age wouldn't have known about. Like, I suddenly wanted to learn how to play jacks. And I remember asking my grandmother, will you teach me how to play jacks?
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about slingshots. So I had my dad make me a slingshot.
Mm-hmm. Stuff that children of that time period.
Of the 80s.
Yeah.
Not super popular or super common.
No.
Especially for a little girl.
No. But certainly common in the 1930s mm-hmm. for a little boy. Yeah. That if you want to hear more about that, you can listen to our other program, Real Ghost Stories Online. And you also write about it in our book, too.
Yeah, in our first book. It's yeah. in my chapter where I talk about my introduction to the paranormal.
Yeah, Real Ghost Stories, Haunting Encounters Told by Real People, which is available on Amazon. You got several pages about your experience in there. Let's continue on with the story. A large granite memorial on the median of Texas State Highway 42 across from the school site was erected in 1939 and commemorates the disaster. Over the years, the New London school explosion received surprisingly little attention, given the magnitude of the events. Explanations for this are speculative, but most center around residents' unwillingness to discuss the tragedy. L.V. Barber said of his father, Lonnie, "I can remember newspaper people coming around every now and then asking him questions about that day, and he never had much to say." A former student mentioned in 2007, "People were afraid to talk about it. Almost no family in this community was unaffected, and whenever people would tell us about the explosion, it would be sort of in whispers and don't say anything in front of so-and-so because they lost a sister." In recent years, as the disaster has gained a historical perspective, it has been increasingly covered by researchers and journalists. The 50th anniversary of the event in 1987 was commemorated in part by the release of a documentary, A Day a Generation Died, written, produced, and directed by Jerry Gumbert. In 1998, the London Museum and Tea House across the highway from the school site opened. Its first curator, Molly Ward, was an explosion survivor. In March of 2012, survivors and others gathered together at the town's rebuilt school in remembrance of the 75th anniversary of the disaster.